This is Oral History Interview number 22. We are talking today with Dr. Herbert Anderson. Dr. Anderson, could you tell us something about your family and early childhood?
I was born in western Kentucky, outside of Paducah, the home of Irving Cobb, and Vice President Alvin Barkley. And as such, I was out in the county, and I was the youngest of seven children. And I went to the county high school, 8 miles out of Paducah. Went to the grade school, to a one-room schoolhouse, before going to high school.
Did you have to walk miles to get to school, as we sometimes hear?
When I was in grade school, I walked a mile and a half to school.
Mm-hmm.
But in high school, I either drove a horse and buggy, or during the better season, I rode a bicycle.
I see. Mm-hmm. Was your what was your father's occupation?
He was a horticulturist.
I see.
I went to school on the product of apples.
Mm-hmm.
Although the main product of that country was tobacco. Apples happened to be my father's occupation.
I see. So he grew apples, but no tobacco. He specialized
no tobacco.
Then in apples. And you mentioned the grade school was a one-room schoolhouse. What was the high school like?
The high school was much better than a one-room school. It was conducted by several teachers, and it was quite different.
Mm-hmm. How many students were there in the one-room schoolhouse then?
In the one-room school, there was usually about 40.
40 people,
yes. Yes.
40 students. What were your interests and activities outside of school when you were young?
Well, it was farming, of course, and then the usual play that goes with childhood in the farm communities.
You did then help your father in his work.
Very much so. In fact, I became so acquainted with the apple industry that I had no interest in pursuing it. In fact, I intended to study medicine from my earliest recollection.
I see. That was going to be my next question, actually. Was, what do you think attracted you to medical school or to becoming a doctor?
My mother's brother was a doctor who came to St. Louis to study medicine at the old Missouri Medical College, which later became part of Washington University. And I liked this uncle very much, and as far back as I can remember, that was the objective.
Mm-hmm. Did he live in the same area as you and your parents did? Or?
Yes, he did. He was the only doctor for that area of McCracken County.
How did you choose which college to attend, or did you, was it necessary to attend college before going to medical school then?
Oh yes, yes. I went to my family happened to belong to the Baptist Church, and the Georgetown College up in Georgetown, Kentucky, was the Baptist institution for that area. In fact, it's the oldest Baptist institution west of the Alleghenies. And so I went to Georgetown College.
And when you went, with the idea of becoming a doctor.
Yes.
Did you take pre-med courses then? Or did?
That is right. I went through for the degree.
Mm-hmm. So you were there 4 years?
I was there 4 years.
4 years.
Yes. I had the AB degree on entering Washington University.
And what were your majors then?
The major then was in English, strange to say.
Mm-hmm.
The instructions were to get as much as you could, fulfill the requirements for the medical school, but to get the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
So I majored in English.
Mm-hmm. Were there any teachers there that particularly impressed you?
Yes, the dean of the school, named John L. Hale, and also the professor of Greek, George Raglan, both of them outstanding personalities.
Mm-hmm. once you, what made you decide on Washington University as a medical school?
My uncle had gone to Missouri Medical College, as I alluded to a few moments mm-hmm. ago, and I knew that Washington University was one of the two universities of St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
and that was my choice.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's the only place I applied for medical school.
There was competition to get into medical school then too, wasn't there?
It frightened me when mm-hmm. I got up here, and several months later I found out over 600 had applied,
mm-hmm.
and I had applied only one place.
Mm-hmm. Over 600, and approximately how large was the class then?
The class was, I believe, about 68 mm-hmm. in the class. I had to limit it because it didn't have enough mm-hmm. cadavers for
I see.
A larger class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So 68 in the entering class, could you tell us approximately how many there were in the graduating class?
If I remember correctly, about 75.
About 75. How did this increase come about?
Transfer from two-year medical schools.
Were there any of your teachers that particularly impressed you in medical school?
Yes, there were two or three outstanding ones. Dr. Evarts Graham.
Could you tell us something about Dr. Graham, and if you had classes from him or your contacts with him?
He was the head of the Department of Surgery and outstanding personality. He was not exactly a warm personality, but he inspired people to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that time that he and others did the work on the gallbladder dye,
mm-hmm.
and also on the removal of lung for cancer, of the bronchi.
Were you in classes that he taught, or did you watch him perform surgery? Or?
I was in classes that he taught.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him operate, I think, twice.
Mm-hmm. What did you particularly, do you remember anything else about him, his manner of teaching?
He had a great admiration for medical history, and we had a coordinating course about once a week during our junior and senior years, and he talked on the history of medicine,
mm-hmm.
and he was quite adept at that mm-hmm. because he was well versed in it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good technician as a surgeon, I understand, and when I saw him, of course, I had not had enough to know
mm-hmm.
by that time, but he impressed me as a good technician.
Mm-hmm. What other teachers do you remember?
Well, no one could possibly forget Dr. Ernie Sachs. He was the neurosurgeon, but he had a Thursday clinic in which we met in the amphitheater of Barnes Hospital, and he would bring in a patient and bring two students down from the class, and they would examine the patient, and then he would quiz them on what they thought about the patient.
Mm-hmm.
One of them in particular, I remember, one morning brought in this colored man who had an obvious Colles fracture. The two boys examined him, and he turned to one of them and says, "What do you find?" He says, "He has a fracture." He says, "Well, what would you do?" He says, "I would take an x-ray." And then Dr. Sachs, in his characteristically, says, "Why?"
Mm-hmm.
And the boy furnished the pabulum for the rest of the lecture. The boy answered, "For your own protection." Well, that led off Dr. Sachs to say that if anybody was in the medical profession for his own protection, it's high time he was out mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked for the rest of the hour on that subject.
Do you remember any of the someone else?
Yes, Dr. Barney Brooks, mm-hmm. who was the teacher of surgical pathology. And everyone always followed him almost verbatim in their notes, because he lectured rather slowly so that they could copy down what they wanted to. We had no means of taping anything in those days. It was mouth to pencil and to the paper. But he was also a very good surgeon and a good teacher, and when he left here, he went to Vanderbilt University.
Were there any other teachers you'd like to tell us about?
Well, there's a pediatrician named Dr. Cook, who was an excellent teacher of pediatrics. Excellent personality, a rather warm personality, as most pediatricians should be. And he was a very, very good teacher.
Could you tell us something about your contacts with fellow students in medical school? Did you have certain friends throughout the whole term?
Yes, we had medical fraternities in those days, but unlike college fraternities, we crossed over the fraternal lines and we were fraternized with one another, and it was a very congenial class. I happen to be a member of the Phi Rho Sigma fraternity, but that made no difference. We liked one another.
How did medical education differ then from today?
Well, it was in those days, very, very few of the students were married. That's in quite contrast to the present time, when I think the majority of the students are married. Back in those days, the fraternities were quite popular with the students, and most of the students belonged to one fraternity or another. And now the fraternities that we thought would never die no longer exist on the campus. I think that's one phase of it. I think the teaching perhaps is no better today than it was then, because we thought it was the very best of the best. And we liked it. In fact, it's during the summer. One year I came back to do the outpatient obstetrics down where the urban renewal is now, down around the railway tracks and down around the river. Of course, that's all cleared away. There are no patients down there now. So where they do their outpatient obstetrics, I do not know in these days.
What other types of things did you do in your summers while in medical school?
I usually went back to Kentucky and did some work on the farm where my father was doing the apple raising. But this one year I came back and did this outpatient work between the junior and senior year.
Were the classes, you mentioned there were some 60 students in the freshman class. Did that mean that each class was this large, or did they divide the freshman class into more parts?
This was a class as a whole. We took our anatomy all together, and we had our lectures all together. Fact is, the class is supposed to be 75. But whether they couldn't select that many students or not out of the 600, that was a different thing.
Did you find there was a lot of competition between the students then, and much pressure to succeed and to compete?
The competition was great even in those days. There's no question about that. But there was no hostility in so doing. If one made better grade than the other, congratulations to them.
Where did you take your internship?
I went to California. My roommate of those days, his father was superintendent of the California Lutheran Hospital in Los Angeles. And so I went out there to take the internship with him.
Mm-hmm. Was it a general internship?
It was. Comparable to any good internship in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Hospital of about 400 beds. And it was a good rotating internship.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after you finished your internship?
I took a preceptorship with the chief surgeon of this hospital, who was also a very good teacher, and I spent 5.5 years with him. It was a superior type of residency, practically.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went into private practice alone.
Was this in California?
Yes, in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Well, was your practice then limited to surgical patients, or?
In greater part. At first it was some general practice, but very quickly it was limited to surgery,
mm-hmm.
because I became a member of the American College of Surgeons 7 years after graduation, which was the minimum amount
I see.
You could spend out mm-hmm. before becoming a member
mm-hmm.
of the American College.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be limited.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what type of surgical surgery did you do?
It gravitated towards abdominal surgery.
Mm-hmm.
The, of course, in California, most of the people who do abdominal surgery do goiters and breasts, do pelvic
mm-hmm.
surgery. Maybe some varicose veins, but beyond that, no bone,
mm-hmm.
No urology, no vascular surgery.
Mm-hmm. Did you continue to practice in California? Was this in Los Angeles?
That's right. I've been in the same
mm-hmm.
place all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
From then, really the time of your internship to the present time, you have been in the same place.
That's right.
Dr. Deutsch mentioned to me that you were a naval surgeon also. Could you tell us something about this?
When World War II came along, I had a notice from the Manpower Commission that I was available for entering into the military service. I chose to join the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I entered into the Navy as a lieutenant commander. Went the first year to San Diego Naval Hospital
mm-hmm.
And was there the chief surgeon for the dependents of the Navy and Marine personnel, which is a tremendous facility
mm-hmm.
and had lots and lots of people.
Excuse me. In San Diego, did you dealt with the families of naval personnel? Did you deal with naval personnel themselves also?
Not during the year I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I went to sea for 2 years, and during those 2 years,
I see.
I dealt with the Navy
mm-hmm.
personnel, Marine personnel.
Mm-hmm. So you were 1 year in San Diego, and then you went to sea. What type of ships did you serve on?
I served on only one ship, the
mm-hmm.
USS Wharton. That was a hospital transport type of ship.
Mm-hmm.
I was senior medical officer aboard ship, and we had 7 operating rooms aboard the ship so that we could take care of the wounded
mm-hmm.
during combat, as we did at Guam
mm-hmm.
During the retaking of Guam. Our ship and 2 other ships took all of the wounded after the 3rd day of the invasion until our ship was loaded with wounded when we took them back to Pearl Harbor.
I see. You must have handled a tremendous number of cases then, working on a hospital ship.
Yes, it was quite busy, particularly during the that time.
Mm-hmm. So the hospital ship would follow the course of battles then, and then pick up the casualties.
Yes, and then back and forth.
And then go to Pearl Harbor and Then they would leave there, and then you'd go back for
that's
more
right.
casualties.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I didn't realize exactly how that was done. And you were there 2 years on the Horton?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And we took out the Marines and left them at various places, mm-hmm. and then we'd pick up the wounded and
I
bring
see.
Back.
So on the way out then you served as a troop transport.
Transport,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then on the way back you were dealing with the casualties. Were there, how many other doctors were there then in this hospital ship?
Part of the time we had a skeleton crew, particularly going west
mm-hmm.
with the Marines. We'd have only about four or five doctors
mm-hmm.
with me, a total
mm-hmm.
of five or six.
Mm-hmm.
But during the combat, particularly of Guam, we had, if I remember correctly, 12.
Yes.
About 138 mm-hmm. corpsmen during that time.
Did you perform then only the surgery that was absolutely necessary before they got back to Pearl Harbor, or did you perform all of the surgery?
We tried not to do definitive surgery aboard ship if possible. That was the instructions from the Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we had to do rather definitive things, particularly if it was abdominal
mm-hmm.
Wounds.
Mm-hmm. Did your hospital ship ever come under enemy attack?
Yes, but not close enough to have any hit from the enemy
mm-hmm.
shelling. But at Guam, we were under attack.
Mm-hmm. Was it painted as a hospital ship?
No,
it was
not.
It was a
gray.
I see.
No.
Mm-hmm. So the enemy couldn't really know whether if you were functioning as a hospital ship
no.
or as a troop transport.
That's
right. You were there. And you were on the ship for 2 years. What other places did you visit in the Pacific, or did the ship go to besides Guam?
We were down at we were down at New Mayo. We were in the Western Carolines, Ulithi. We were up at Okinawa. We were in Inuvituk, the Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the Ellis Islands.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, we made during that time 12 crossings. Of the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the Philippines at Leyte and Samar during the fighting period.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the war, did you ever get to Japan or close to it?
As a private citizen,
mm-hmm.
I went back aboard the SS Woodrow Wilson. I resolved if I ever had the money and had the chance, I was going to cross this ocean one time under air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one
mm-hmm.
opportunity.
Mm-hmm. What were physical conditions like aboard the ship? You mentioned that there was no air conditioning.
Well, it was blackout at night. I had being senior medical officer, I had a private room myself with a starboard port and a forward port.
Mm-hmm.
I did not smoke. I was not a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
So the captain, through his own generosity, let me have my two port holes open
mm-hmm.
at night,
mm-hmm.
which was worth a lifetime of not smoking, because when you cross the equator with all the port holes closed,
mm-hmm.
the heat is almost intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the heat is so intense as you cross the equator, you forget from one trip to the next just exactly how hot it is.
Mm-hmm.
You could lie there with your fan going on you and still the perspiration rolls off of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But the rest of the ship was all blacked out.
I see.
Because of enemy
mm-hmm.
attack or submarine attack.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have the early morning watch at daybreak, which was the great time for attack by
submarine. I see.
Mm-hmm. We'd all be at our quarters.
Mm-hmm. What was the food like aboard the ship?
Most excellent. Mm-hmm. Of course, the officers had their own mess, but I had to inspect the, being senior medical officer, I had to inspect the crew's food, mm-hmm. pass on, but they had wonderful food, mm-hmm. no problem.
Mm-hmm. Were you on the ship then until the end of the war?
I was there, yes, until after the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
I was happened to be at Pearl Harbor when the end of the war came,
mm-hmm.
in August, mm-hmm. I believe it was 45.
Mm-hmm. What did you do when you got out of the service?
I came back to private practice. I rested up for about 2 months and then was, mm-hmm. back into private practice, mm-hmm. again, Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Doing surgery, specializing in surgery then?
That's right, abdominal,
mm-hmm.
surgery.
Mm-hmm. What type of professional organizations do you belong to in Los Angeles?
I belong to, of course, the Los Angeles County Medical Association, and by virtue of that, you're a member of the Surgical Society of that area.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm on the national, the American College of Surgeons, the International College of Surgeons, American Society of Abdominal Surgeons.
Did you attend many of the national meetings?
I try to attend every year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I suppose these meetings, are they held all over the United States, and are they held abroad too?
Yes, most of them are here in America. The American College of Surgeons in recent years has had meetings abroad. I went abroad twice with American College, once to England,
mm-hmm.
and then we were invited by the Swedish Surgical Society another year, and we went to Stockholm to another meeting.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then the American Society of Abdominal, mm-hmm. Surgeons has annually an international meeting that meets in various parts of Europe. I've been to several of those.
I see. Mm-hmm. The how many surgical cases did you do in a day when after World War II, when your practice was very busy?
After I came home?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was getting off started again was a little slow,
mm-hmm.
but 1 to 3, we tried to bunch them together if possible,
mm-hmm.
but at the beginning did not operate every day, but in recent years though operate almost every day,
mm-hmm.
of the week,
mm-hmm.
except Saturday and Sunday.
Have you retired now from practice completely?
No, I'm just as active now as I was 25 years ago.
You are. Oh, that's very unusual. When I asked one doctor if he had retired, this was last year, he said, well, why ask me that? Why don't you assume that I'm still active? And I guess I should have done that with you too, assume that you were still active and working.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Well, what type of practice are you still in surgery? If you limited to yourself to one specialty in
abdominal surgery.
Abdominal surgery.
Abdominal surgery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Still do. Of course, goiters are not done as much now as they were years ago, but still do goiters.
I see.
Do breasts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you've never really retired. Do you plan to retire someday?
As long as I have my faculties, mm-hmm. and mentally okay,
mm-hmm.
and agile,
mm-hmm.
I plan to keep on.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Have you been active in any specific community activities in Los Angeles? What are your interests in
yes,
this field?
Largely in musical things. I'm not a golfer.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play tennis some. But I'm a member of the California Club, which is one of our better clubs of California. And the musical phase of it takes us to the symphony
mm-hmm.
year by year as season ticket holders of the Los Angeles Philharmonic
mm-hmm.
Orchestra
mm-hmm.
and then of the Light Opera. We're also guarantors of the Light Opera
mm-hmm.
season. My love for the Light Opera came when I was a student in St. Louis with the Municipal Light Opera here
mm-hmm.
in Forest Park.
Yeah.
We find it very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. This is sometimes puzzled me. The municipal opera in Forest Park doesn't seem to do any opera or light opera anymore. It seems to do more popular musicals. And I was wondering how it did get its name. So then they in the past they have done light opera there apparently. Then.
Well, when I was a student here in St. Louis, it was all light opera.
It was. Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, they did have grand opera.
I see.
Out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My first encounter with Aida was
I
in
see.
The Municipal
mm-hmm.
Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, they had 10,000 seats and 7,500 were paid admissions and 2,500 seats were free to the community, whoever would like to come.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's true today or not.
They still have some free seats, but not that many by any means. Perhaps about 300, something like that. I think it's about the back eight rows are free, and the rest are not.
Maybe the financial status
mm-hmm.
of the community has advanced to the point where they don't have 2,500 that might want to go free.
Mm-hmm. Well, the free seats always seem to be full, no matter what is on.
Think for a second here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I might say a few things. Yes.
Fine.
Mm-hmm. No. You want to record it?
Yes.
No?
Could you tell us of your something more about your medical practice, medical profession?
It's not insurance, it's all private practice, referral by other doctors and by satisfied patients. It seems that the practice of abdominal surgery, general surgery, is most satisfactory and more stable if one relies on the satisfied patients. The fact
mm-hmm.
is I have patients now that come back from great distances
mm-hmm.
For surgery on themselves or members of the family, which
mm-hmm.
I treasure
mm-hmm.
as a compliment to the quality of surgery that they had.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone abroad every year for 21 consecutive years. Most of those were for study. I was particularly fond of going back to the University of Vienna, and I've been back there some 12 years at the Allgemeines Krankenhaus, which is under the University of Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in finding out how they did surgery. I know how American people do surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And while over there, I encountered the repair of the hiatal hernia by the Nissen method. Dr. Nissen is a Swiss surgeon, so on two different years I went up to the University of Basel in order to talk with Dr. Nissen about
mm-hmm.
the repair of the hiatal hernia. In 1956, by chance, according to Dr. Nissen, he came upon this method. The anesthetist told him one morning that when he was doing the classical type of sewing of the crura, that the patient was not doing bad. He was an elderly gentleman, so he very quickly attached the lesser curvature of the stomach to the abdominal wall, expecting to go back later and repair it, and he found out he didn't have to go back. He had discovered another new method.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular method has been largely abandoned now. And the so-called Nissen fundoplication, which is all over the world. And I learned it over there and brought it back to Los Angeles to practice it there. But back to Vienna, they teach the technique of doing abdominal surgery on the cadaver. They have the privilege there of having fresh cadavers, almost unlimited number. If one dies in a general hospital or dies out on the street, by a decree of Maria Theresa many years ago, they could take these bodies without permit from the family and use them for scientific purposes. So the professor of the surgery may be operating in the hospital in the morning and then over in the legal medicine part in the afternoon teaching students from the various parts of the world. When I say students, these are postgraduate doctors there to learn how to do their method. And it's most exhilarating. The fact is I learned how to do the Bilroth 1 gastric resection while there. And incidentally, in the professor of surgery's office, there's a specimen, which is the specimen from the very first successful gastric resection in the world. And that was done by Dr. Bilroth back in 1881. And that specimen looks as though it had been preserved maybe less than a month ago. So it's a treasure of the University of Vienna. The sutures are all visible, and this particular operation today is done very much like Dr. Bilroth did it back in 1881.
I see.
Some of them do Bilroth too, and incidentally, practically all of the gastric surgery originated in the University of Vienna. For instance, the popular vagotomy, which incidentally too is losing somewhat its favor now, started with Professor Mandel at the University of Vienna. Gregstedt claims no originality for the vagotomy procedure. He learned it under Professor Mandel and brought it to America and popularized it, and it's all over America now. It is the operation of choice for duodenal ulcer. However, many of the old-timers, like myself, I still stay with the gastric resection, like Dr. Evarts Graham did. And I find it very successful, doing either the Bilroth 1 or the Bilroth 2 type of procedure, learned at the University of Vienna. I think that's... The Allgemeines Krankenhaus at Vienna has around 5,000 beds, and they ran a large series of vagotomies, and they have now practically abandoned, except on rare occasions, doing any vagotomies whatsoever. They're back doing the Bilroth 1 or Bilroth 2 operations for duodenal ulcer. That's somewhat in contrast to some of the surgery that's done in America.
Why have they done, why have they switched?
They had too many complications. They had too many people with diarrhea with the vagotomies. Some have been completely debilitated with the diarrheas. In fact, is I have a friend who had a vagotomy done, and he was practically out of practice for 4 years because of the vagotomy. Of course, a lot of them are perfectly successful with it, but the Bilroth 1 or Bilroth 2 resection in the hands of those who do them seems to fulfill the requirements for healing the ulcers of the duodenum.
You mentioned a man in New Orleans, and I didn't quite get his connection to this.
Dr. Ochsner graduated from Washington University and was a protege of Evarts Graham. And he went down to New Orleans to be professor of surgery at Tulane University. And he's an outstanding authority in gastric surgery. well as several other fields of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But he is very much opposed to any type of vagotomies, as well as he's opposed to anybody smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the cancer possibility with the one who smokes.
Mm-hmm.
And that also originated here at Washington University under the work of Dr. Evarts Graham.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other part of your professional work you'd like to say a little bit more about?
I think that takes in the greater part of it.
I see. Well, we certainly appreciate you coming here today and allowing us to interview you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.